We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present, unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It is October 4, 2015. Here on the Dark Matter Digital Network, we are live every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. And we've got a great show for you here tonight. We've had a lot of very interesting guests over the last several months, talking all sorts of different topics. One thing we have not been talking about a lot of late is the subject of UFOs. And tonight is going to be a fun one, as we will be joined by Nick Pope here on the program in about 30 minutes from his website. Nick Pope used to run the British government's UFO project. From 1991 to 1994, he researched and investigated UFOs, alien abductions, crop circles, and other strange phenomena, leading the media to call him the real Fox Mulder. His government background and his level-headed views have made him the media, film, and TV industry's go-to guy when it comes to UFOs, the unexplained, and conspiracy theories. As the world's leading expert on UFOs, Nick Pope has consulted on and helped to promote a number of alien-themed movies, TV shows, and video games. He has presented, consulted, and contributed to numerous television shows, has written 5 best-selling books, and lectures all around the world. Nick Pope is going to be on the show tonight, and it is going to be a very, very fun show. We're going to talk to him about UFOs. We're going to talk to him about the infamous Rendlesham Forest incident, which he literally wrote the book about. And in fact, it just came out. It's a brand new book. We'll be talking about that on the program here today. And we'll also be talking about some of the other things that he basically will talk about anything. And he writes a lot about conspiracies as well. And so we'll talk about that with Nick Pope on the show here tonight. As always, we're going to be taking your phone calls, emails, text messages, and so much more here on the show. I've got a lot of very interesting news stories to read as well. And I want to direct everybody to the website, afterdarkradioshow.com. Everything you need to know about this program is up there. The studio line, 425-488-0525. That is 425-488-0525. You can send us a Skype message by dialing F4W Online. That is our Skype number if you want to give us a call on Skype, F4W Online. If you want to send us a text message, you can text to 425-780-7566. Please don't call that number. Nobody's going to answer. That's only for text messages. My email address is brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. We can do some emails tonight as well. You can follow me on Twitter, @BrianAlvarez. I got all sorts of great stuff up there on Twitter. And the Facebook page is facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. Andrew Lutsky runs the Facebook page, and he puts usually about 3 articles up every day, so it will not bombard your timeline, but always interesting articles. He is also the man to contact on Facebook, through the After Dark Radio Show Facebook page if you want to be a guest on the show, or if you have a guest request. We often have people saying, hey, you should get so-and-so on the show. Well, if you've got a request, go to the Facebook page and contact Andrew. He will get that information to Kenneth, who is our main producer in terms of contacting the guests, and he will get you or your guest lined up for the program. So, once again, all of this information is up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. All of the phone numbers, emails, etc. We'll be going over those throughout the program here tonight. Should also mention that if you missed last week's program, in which we interviewed Aphrodite Jones of Investigation Discovery about various true crimes, that show is available right now on the website as a free MP3 download. Absolutely free. However, if you are listening live, you're only going to be able to get that show for the next 2 hours or so, because as soon as this program goes off the air, it will no longer be available. So head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, download that, and join the fun. As far as news, we got a lot to talk about tonight, including a UFO museum being investigated by the FBI. We've got an alien implant story from India. We got some other interesting stories as well, including around here, actually, there is a remote BC island where bizarre howls have sparked a Sasquatch hunt, and a buddy of mine wants me to go investigate with him. Perhaps we shall. I've got a couple of other investigations I'm thinking about doing, and maybe some, there's a Sasquatch summit coming up that I really want to go to in November. If you're in the Seattle area, maybe you can head out there as well. I'll be talking about that in the coming weeks. But anyway, let's get the show kicked off with open lines to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
Yes, Ryan.
I had a question about the end of the world area. I noticed on September 24th, I missed an end of the world type experience at work as my boss was making fun of me for taking the day off on Wednesday. And when I came back, we were walking down the steps together. And when I walked out the door, I saw 100 of my coworkers outside. But the fire department, basically there was a gas leak in the building, and they forgot to tell us that there was a gas leak.
There was a gas leak in the building, and they forgot to tell you?
Well, either that or they were investigating gas leak, but everyone else had been...
Or maybe they were trying to take you out, Ryan. You ever thought about that?
Well, everyone else was working in our department. Just our department wasn't informed.
So they were trying to take out everybody?
Well, except, you know, fourth floor was the only people that weren't told about it.
How about that?
And I bet it's like on September 11th that the 911 had to be called because someone got stuck in the elevator. And also on Friday the 13th, I noticed the wrestler got seriously injured at one of the shows I went to after he had a slip on the ropes doing it.
So what's your point? The world's ending? Is that what you're trying to say, Ryan?
Well, what I'm saying is these dates seem to like create bad luck, you know, when... You know, I don't know if it's like it gets in people's heads and something actually happens, or it seems odd these three instances.
Oh, well, happen. I'm sure. I want to thank you very much for the call, Ryan. I'm sure that's part of it. I mean, if you believe that the end of the world is coming on a specific date, if the world doesn't end, if you're worried about it enough, I'm sure you can manifest all sorts of terrible things in your life. It makes a lot of sense. So don't believe it is my answer, Ryan. Although, I would talk to whoever didn't tell you about the gas leak in the building because could have been bad news. James here in the email bin says, Brian, love your show. Have you heard about the Servant Girl Annihilator? He was a serial killer in Austin, Texas, 3 years before Jack the Ripper hit London. A suspect in the Austin killings was a Malay cook. The cook left Austin and sailed to London, and soon after the Ripper murders began... The cook was also considered a suspect by London police. There is some stuff on Google about this. Might be an interesting topic for an episode, assuming you've not already done so. I've not done an episode on that, but I will check that out a little bit later on, and maybe we can get somebody on to talk about it. If you have a subject, the best thing you can do is contact me about it, and also, if there is a book about it, if there is a link to anybody who has talked about it or written about it, send that to me as well, and then I can try and get that person on the air and talk about some of these subjects. This person here says, I'm listening to the latest episode of After Dark. One of the callers mentioned a Wikipedia article on end-of-the-world predictions, so I thought I'd have a look at it. I had a quick look through, and one entry caught my eye. The Amazing Criswell, the predicted date of the end of the world according to the psychic, well known for his false predictions. Obviously, with a name and description like that, I had to find out more about him, so I read his Wikipedia article and discovered that he recorded an LP of his predictions called The Legendary Criswell Predicts Your Incredible Future, which I was able to find on YouTube. I'm not sure if Criswell believed these predictions or not. There are a few that resemble some things that have happened. He directly mentions color TV and 3D TV, though admittedly, these do seem like an obvious progression, although others are a bit further from reality, to say the least. But either way, it is quite an interesting listen. You can find it on YouTube if you're interested. Criswell Predicts is what you search for. And then he has some nice things to say about the Figure 4 website as well. So check out Criswell Predicts on the website. Want to send a shout out to Shannon here, who discovered After Dark Radio recently and has been going through the archives at WrestlingObserver.com. And essentially, she's made it to 2014 now. And she says, congratulations on being the first radio show broadcast on the Dark Matter Digital Network. I can't wait to catch up so that I can contribute to things that aren't from 2013. I don't think I was the first show, but I believe I was the first show that went live on the Dark Matter Digital Network. So that, in fact, is true. This person here says, sleep paralysis. I think we read this one at... Actually, we did read this one last week. Brian at AfterDarkRadioShow.com if you want to send an email here, and don't forget the text line as well. I'll be going through more emails as the show goes on. This person via text message says, why are we still talking about the end of the world? Time has to exist for the world to end, and time does not. Doesn't that conclude the world won't end? I bet I know who that is. Always fixated on time. Let's talk some aliens here before we go to our interview with Nick Pope. This here from MysteriousUniverse.org. Mysterious Japanese UFO museum investigated by the FBI. A report has been circulating about an FBI investigation into a mysterious UFO museum in Japan that may have revealed to the public a memo about a UFO crash and the alien bodies recovered there. What is in the memo, and what is in this secret UFO museum? According to reports, the redacted memo is from March 22, 1950, and describes an eyewitness's account of the discovery of flying saucers in New Mexico and a possible cause of the crashes. Here's what's in the memo. It says, quote, an investigator for the Air Force states that three so-called flying saucers had been recovered in New Mexico. They were described as being circular in shape and raised centers approximately 50 feet in diameter. Each one was occupied by three bodies of human shape, but only 3 feet tall, dressed in metallic cloth of a very fine texture. Each body was bandaged in a manner similar to the blackout suits used by speed flyers and test pilots. According to Mr. Redacted here, the informant, the saucers were found in New Mexico due to the fact that the government has a very high-powered radar set up in that area, and it is believed that radar interferes with the controlling mechanism of the saucers. Now, that's interesting because that has been a story that people have talked about now for years and years and years when discussing possible UFO crashes, that there may be something involved with the radar and the saucers that causes interference and causes them to crash. I was always skeptical whenever people talked about Roswell, the idea that these alien beings would fly through interstellar space, something we are currently incapable of doing to the level of what they apparently achieved, yet they get to Earth and are immediately struck by lightning. I always found that to be ridiculous, actually. But this is at least a better explanation. They were unprepared for our radar. There was radar interference, and they crashed. Article says, despite that detailed account, there doesn't seem to be much information available about this recovery of aliens and their ships. The memo was kept in the vaults of the FBI, where it seems they hoped it would be forgotten, and it was, until 1994. That's when it was announced that an international UFO research center would open in Hakui, Japan. According to another FBI memo from that time, the center would have a library containing over 10,000 official documents relating to UFO phenomena gathered from multiple countries that would be available to researchers and, the part that concerned them the most, to the general public. It appears the FBI's concern may have had an impact on what is now called the Cosmo Isle Hakui Space and UFO Museum. While the main building is shaped like a flying saucer, the museum's emphasis seems to be more on space memorabilia, with exhibits on both U.S. and Russian missions, including Vostok 1, the actual Russian spacecraft that took the first person into orbit in 1961, which brings us back to the museum and the 1950 memo. Why is the memo suddenly in the news again? Has something new been found about the 1950 crash that's being covered up again? Is the museum going back to its original goal of finding and making public information about UFOs and alien encounters? If so, it is about time. So that is a story to be followed. And if you want to know more, you can head up to mysteriousuniverse.org, which is where that story there came from. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Jeff from California.
Yes, Jeff. What's happening?
Not much, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I have exploding head syndrome.
Really?
I am an actual, sufferer, I guess you could say.
How about that? How often do you suffer from this?
It's totally random. Started probably, I remember specifically, in my late 20s is when it really kicked in. And I could have had it before then, but...
Now, for those of you that may be tuning in for the first time, exploding head syndrome is a real thing. His head does not actually explode.
No.
It's essentially you're sleeping, and you hear, like, this tremendous bang noise. And is there, like, a flash of light as well?
There can be. There has been. Mainly, yeah, it does happen in, like, the twilight zone. But it does. It's happened to me wide awake as well.
So, have you gone to the doctor? Do they have any recommendations? Do they just...
No, I did once kind of complain about it, but I thought I was absolutely insane for years and years. And I figured I would just be dead one time, you know, it would happen, and I wouldn't even realize it, and I'd be gone. But I think in 2004, I finally Googled it, and I found out what I was suffering from. All those years, I had no idea.
You know, it's funny. I don't recommend that people, like, go on the internet and diagnose themselves, but Google has become very handy in the sense that I think there's a lot of things that people worried about in the past that now that there's Google and they can anonymously just go on there and search for their symptoms, I think it's probably helped more people than it's hurt.
Well, in this case, it did because I Googled shotgun blast in the head or something like that. And you talked about it a couple weeks ago. The Wikipedia page just popped up and it was actually a real relief. It really was.
I remember when my grandmother had this, she actually went to the hospital. Like, she thought she was having a stroke or something. And she went all the way to the hospital. They did all the tests, and they said you were fine and everything like that. And the reason I found it originally was she told me her symptoms. She said, I was awake, and there was a flash and a bang. And I can't remember the rest of the thing that she told me, but essentially, I went into Google, and I typed it word for word like she'd said. And that was the first thing that came up. And then that was what it was confirmed to be, so... Yeah, exploding head syndrome. It's probably pretty freaky.
It's horrible. Actually, even like I'll be watching sports or something, and as like say a ball approaches a bat, when it hits the bat, I'll like jump or have like a shot go through my body. It's crazy. It's really, I don't know how to explain that.
Now, I forget, is there something that happens after the flash and the bang? Is there, like, period of missing memory, or is it just
sometimes it depends. Like, it's variable from like a super incredible loud blast to maybe my body will just tweak or twitch. But sometimes if I'm sort of sleeping, I'll pop up and like be in a total panic, you know, like obviously the world is ending is kind of how it feels.
Well, I want to thank you very much for calling in and sharing that experience. And hopefully if there are other people out there that maybe have never heard of this, it might be something you can check out and maybe talk to your doctor about and not go through years and years like this poor guy did, thinking that one of these days it's just going to blow up and you'll be dead. Should I mention that we got a text message here from somebody wanting me to alert everybody that if you're a subscriber to the Wrestling Observer website, there is an After Dark section on the board. And so if you want to pop in there and discuss whatever we're talking about here on the shows, you are welcome to do so. And he also wants me to give a shout out to Hector in Brownsville, who hasn't called in several months. We actually have a few callers that are regular callers that are calling in less after we switched to the Sunday, 9 p.m. midnight Eastern time slot. Our old time slot was 11 Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern. And so we had a whole different crew of regulars that was calling in at that time. You, of course, are welcome to call in tonight. It's open lines 425-488-0525. Put that in your phone, 425-488-0525. That is the studio line. And if you want to Skype us, F4W Online is the Skype number and the text message number, 425-780-7566. Nick Pope is going to be joining us to talk about UFOs here in a bit. I want to read one more article here as it relates to UFOs. Alien implant from India. This is from alienhunter.org. An organization, mind you. Alienhunter.org. And just back from my trip to India, it was epic in many ways. To experience this rich ancient culture firsthand was a wonderful opportunity. I made friends and allies, and we've got the start of an effective research organization there. My young investigators have all the right stuff, and we hope to break to the stigma against a topic that exists in this fascinating country. The case they uncovered that brought me to India involves a bright professional woman in her early 30s. She and some of her family members have experienced multiple contact with what they described as children as, quote, monkey people. Our patient has recall of receiving alien implants at various times in her life. My investigators were impressed with her story, the details and clarity, as well as some of the physical evidence that she presented. They shared her medical records, x-rays, and reports, and after I spoke with her myself, I believed this was a genuine case with the markers of the rare alien implant in her shoulder. The seemingly metallic object was visible beneath the skin as a lump. The patient was resolute to have it removed surgically, which would be a simple procedure. She was also interested in learning more about her contact experiences than she was able to remember. She was very eager for me to come and oversee the surgery personally and work with her privately. Surgery was going to be performed in Delhi under conventional medical setting. Surgeon and the hospital director were very cooperative. They followed my directions about handling the object and importantly, maintaining chain of custody. The entire procedure was documented on video and included five witnesses beside myself. The object, said to be an alien implant, was covered with a biological casing. The surgeon did think this was unusual, but I've seen this before in previous implant surgeries. The pathology testing will reveal if this is a natural inflammatory response or something else, as I suspect. The patient had no physical ill effects. However, that night she did experience extreme terror, sensing they were angry at the object's removal. Similar emotions were also felt by other family members. There is more that I cannot share at this time, but let's just say that I don't mind messing with the aliens program here. Patient took me to Mumbai to meet her family and work with her privately. I was impressed by her sincerity, and the extensive psychological testing gave me insight into her particular case. I suspect there are at least two other sites of previous implantation, and she does exhibit a typical scoop mark on one of her legs. Alienhunter.org is the place to go if you want to follow more on this story, and I presume they are following up on that as well. They did, as noted, remove something, an object covered with a biological casing, and the patient claimed that as children, they remembered abduction experiences and, I guess, contact with what they called the monkey people. Alienhunter.org. To the phones, you're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you. What's going on?
Okay, yeah, my name's Mike. I'm in Oklahoma.
Yes, Mike.
And I'm a first-time caller, and first time I've heard your show. I guess you've switched to Sunday nights, and I understand you're going to have Nick Pope on, which is just absolutely fantastic. Like listening to that guy. I've had some very fantastic, in fact, you could even say beyond fantastic UFO encounters in my life. And I would like to relate one story to you.
Sure.
One night, back in the late, this happened in the late 1980s, I was a ham radio operator, and I used to like to, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there's a road out there called Skyline Boulevard. And if you drive up there, it's in the low mountains on the San Francisco Peninsula. If you drive up there, you can look out over the entire Bay Area and see all the lights at night. And the reason I did it was it's a good place to get out and get radio contacts because I had my mobile ham radio in the Jeep. And across the bay from that point, there's a mountain called Mount Diablo. Mm-hmm. And I made a contact with a guy up there. This was probably, I'm going to say it was 11 o'clock at night, something like that. And I made a contact with a guy up on top of there. And we were talking back and forth, and that's a pretty good distance, really. And as I was talking to him, now, to picture it, my Jeep is pulled out to the edge of this cliff, and behind the Jeep is an old two-lane road, which would be Skyline Boulevard. Just right behind the road is a hill that's probably, I'm going to say, about 50 foot high and just gently slopes off on either side. Well, as I'm talking to this guy, this bright light just lights up the whole area, and it was behind the Jeep, and I'm still looking out over the Bay Area, and I thought it was another car pulling into the pullout because it was a popular spot. The locals in that area called it the Logs, and so I sat there for a few minutes more talking with this guy. And the light just stayed there. And so I put the microphone down and I got out of the Jeep and looked up. And here's this craft above the hill, just behind the Jeep across the road. And it has to be at least 100 to 150 foot across. And it's shining these two beams of light straight down onto the hill behind me. And the beams of light are a rectangle shape, and there's two of them, and they're separated in the middle by a pretty good distance. So what you're looking at is you've got these square beams of light that fan out gently as they meet the ground, coming down to the ground on this giant craft, okay? And I'm going, what the heck? Now, I've been asked, I've only told this story to a few other people, the reason for that is that I felt like I shouldn't tell the story, like maybe I was betraying somebody or like it was a secret and I shouldn't say anything. But I'm older now, and I think it's important for people to know about this stuff, that it is real. And so anyway, my astonishment was at such a high level that there was no fear. I had no fear. I remember that everything was completely silent. It was so silent, it's like the silence was like a heavy blanket. You could feel it. That's how silent it was. And I don't mean just the craft itself. I mean, everything around me was just dead, absolute, still silence.
So, like, it sucked away the sound.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that. I have no idea what it did, but it did something to the sound. You're right. And so I'm looking up at this thing, and inside these two square areas, rectangular areas on the bottom of the craft, inside, inset into those rectangles, were these rows and rows of pyramids pointing straight down. Now, they looked exactly like the ones like in Egypt, except that they were elongated more, so that, you know, if you pulled the top of the Giza pyramid up quite a bit and stretched it out, that's what it looked like. And there was a probably, I'm going to say, 4 to 6 rows of pyramids in an even line, and there was probably, I want to say, 12 pyramids per row. And that was repeated in both rectangles, okay? And they were inset into the craft. Now, at the tip of each triangle, there was a glowing white ball. And I call it plasma balls. Was it a plasma ball? I don't know. But I said the plasma balls. And each tip of the triangle had this ball just away from the tip, and just sitting there glowing, okay? And I could see each rectangle had a covering on it. It was clear, but you could tell it had depth to it. It was thick. And the only thing I can relate it to would be like a big, thick crystal. That's what it reminded me of, okay? And as I'm looking at this thing, I'm just thinking, oh my God, what is this? This is just wow. I mean,
what shape was it?
Excuse me?
What shape was it? Was it round, triangular?
No, it was round, but it was more oval than round.
Okay.
Okay. It was oval. Let me see how I can explain this. The rectangles were end-to-end and in line with each other, okay? So the smaller part of the circle was towards the ends of the rectangle. So the oval part was at the ends of the rectangle, and the longer part of the oval was away from them.
Sure.
And the color of the body, now I could see the body good. Remember, this is nighttime, and I could see the body of the craft really good. And it was kind of a dark blue gray metal, and it didn't shine. It didn't like have a specular, you know. It was like a flat color.
Sure.
And so I'm thinking, wow. So the next thought that comes into my mind is, I'm going to get a hold of this guy that I'm talking to on the radio and see if he can see this thing across the bay. Because, you know, Mount Diablo is a real high mountain there in the Bay Area. And so I get back in the Jeep. I called for him, and he was still there. And I explained to him where I was at across from him on Skyline Boulevard. And I told him to, you know, go ahead and scan that area and see if you see a big light that's shining over there, shining down. And so about a minute later, he comes back and he says, yeah, I see it. I see it. And I said, dude, I am right underneath that thing. And he said, wow, man. He says, I see it. So at that point, I get back out of the Jeep thinking, okay, he sees it too. And I look back up, and the craft is slowly moving. I mean, so slow. It's like, it's not as slow as the hands of a watch, but it's not very much faster, but it's moving towards my car or the Jeep. And it's slowly coming across the road, and it's about 75 feet away. That's how close I was to it. And I didn't feel anything, you know, like on my skin or nothing weird. It's just the craft, myself, and the car. And it's coming over, and the next thing I can't remember too much after that, except that I remember it was directly over the Jeep, and I'm looking straight up at this thing. And at that point, I noticed, you remember the clear covering that's over the rectangles, inside of that crystal-like covering, which was pretty thick, it had these wavy wires, really thin, running through it. And the wires were running in the direction between the rows of the triangles, and it was like a sine wave pattern, okay? And wherever there was a row of triangles, right in between the next row and that row, there would be this wavy wire. I call it a wire. Was it a wire? I don't know, but that's what it looked like. And so I'm looking up at this thing, and then the next thing I know, I mean, I don't remember it moving, but it was back over the top of the hill, and it was just right where it was when I first saw it. And I'm looking at it just amazed beyond. It's the most fantastic thing I've ever seen in my entire life. It just snapped. It blinked out. And I thought, oh, it turned off the lights. So I squinted really hard to see, because I could see a few stars out that night. It was a very clear and still night. And I squinted to see if I could still see it, and it wasn't there. I could see the stars. And so I just kind of shook my head, and I just could not believe what I had just seen. And I got back in the car, I got back on the radio, and I called to the guy across on the on Mount Diablo. I couldn't raise him. He wasn't there. And I was talking earlier in that same spot on one of the channels, and it was a popular channel, a lot of people on that particular ham radio channel. And I broke in, and I called for some people I knew. They weren't out there. So I just sat there, and I just like a blank stare looking out at the Bay Area and the lights and stuff. And this girl comes on the radio, and she's talking to somebody else, and she says, oh, it's been such a weird night out here. There's some guy up on some hill who's talking about UFOs and such and such and such. And I thought, wow, you know, what the heck, you know? And, you know, that I don't, and plus another thing that's weird, now this is such a long time ago, but I still can't remember driving home that evening or even turning off my radio or anything like that. That's only one experience I've had. Years earlier, I had a real...
Well, actually, I hate to cut you off, but we've got to get Nick Pope here on the show. But I do want to thank you very much for that, and I encourage you to call back and tell the other story next week. But once again, thanks for the call. And it is very interesting when he tells that story. We've had many guests on talking about this sort of thing. And he mentioned it was Mount Diablo. And it's come up over and over again, these stories from places with names like Diablo, Devil, Fae, which is an old term for fairies, happens over and over again. And a very, very interesting story. I want to thank you so much for that call. And by the way, if you are a first-time listener, we are here every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, and we are live. And we've got to head to a break because we're going to be back in just a moment with Nick Pope. He's going to be on the show. We're going to be talking tons of UFO stories, Rendlesham Forest, and so much more. Stand by. After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We're back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio, Dark Matter Digital Network. Very happy today to be joined by Nick Pope. We'll be talking all sorts of different topics here, everything from UFOs to conspiracies. And Nick, how you doing today?
Fine, thank you very much.
You know, I was trying to find a great way to introduce you here on the show without trying to write it down, come up with something too complicated. Your biography on your site puts it as simply as possible. Nick Pope used to run the British government's UFO project. That's simple enough.
Yeah.
Let's start with that. The British government's UFO project, you did this for several years. Obviously, when people hear that, there are people who think, man, Nick must know everything. Nick knows secrets. And maybe not quite as romantic as people like to think.
Yes, I have been called by the media the real Fox Mulder. And the work that I did has been likened to the X-Files. But sadly, it was not quite that glamorous. No, it wasn't all running around in dark warehouses with torches and guns and things like that. Sorry, you call them flashlights, don't you? I'm still trying to learn the language over here in America. But yeah, I essentially, my job was to research and investigate UFO sightings reported to the British government. And it's the job I did is broadly analogous to Project Blue Book. I think that's the best way to characterize things.
Now, how exactly does one go about getting that job? How did they approach you? What were your thoughts when they first approached you with this? I mean, one key difference between the U.S. and the U.K. is Project Blue Book, that was the 1960s here. This was the early 90s. Many, many, many years had passed. Tell us a little bit about how this all got started.
Sure. The British government's UFO project actually dates back to the early 50s, and it was started following an initiative from the Ministry of Defense's chief scientific advisor. And he said, look, we shouldn't dismiss these UFO sightings without doing some form of proper scientific investigation into them. I mean, what if there is some defense threat? What if there is something that this phenomenon, whatever it is, could tell us that would be useful in terms of science, technology, etc. So the British government set up a small project to look at that, and a number of different people have done it over the years. And I fell into that job completely by accident. I guess it's not the kind of job you can ring up and ask to do. I was already in the Ministry of Defense. I mean, that's the important point. This was one of a number of different tours of duty that I did in a wider 21-year career as a civilian working for the Ministry of Defense, which is the UK's equivalent of the American DOD. And I was simply sounded out one day. I was due for a move. Somebody came to me and said, we've got a job we'd like you to consider. And I said, what is it? And they said, UFOs. And I kind of did a double take. And I thought, what? Did I hear that right? But I did. I had mixed feelings about it, to be honest. Of course, it sounded interesting, but I was worried that it would look a little bit weird on my internal government CV and that it might prejudice getting good jobs in the future. But in the end, curiosity got the better of me, and I said, okay, sign me up.
Now, what kind of curiosity are we talking about here? I mean, had you had any interest in UFOs, the paranormal, or anything like that prior to them coming to you? Was there a reason they came to you? Did they just, let's ask Nick, what happened?
Well, I think it was two things. Firstly, it was just one of those fortuitous moments where I was looking for a vacancy and a vacancy opened up. The other thing was that I had actually before that been seconded into the Joint Operations Center during the Persian Gulf War. And I was working fairly closely to the manager who had that particular vacancy. So we had established a fairly good working relationship. He, I think, regarded me as a safe pair of hands. So there was that personal connection there, too. But to answer your first question about the level of interest, no, it was no, I had never had a sighting or never even read a book or seen a TV documentary on the subject. I guess it was just a kind of intellectual curiosity. Well, why is the Ministry of Defense looking at this subject at all? Is there anything in the files? Well, I guess I thought if I take the job, I'll find out.
Do you think that you would have done the job any different if you had gone in as someone who was very, very interested in the topic? You'd been reading about it since a child. You always were fascinated in it. Do you think that there would have been a different approach to it had you been like that?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yes, I suspect I would have done. Let me go one step back on that. Firstly, I doubt they would have offered the job to anyone who had expressed an interest. And I did hear through back channel after I left that they were actively making sure that anyone who ever did that job in the future, right up to when the MOD's UFO project was axed in 2009, but I heard that they were pretty much making sure that it was skeptics only and that the job description pretty much said, if you're interested in this, you won't get the job. You have to think it's a load of rubbish, and you have to push that line aggressively with everyone, Parliament, media, public. I think had I gone in as somebody who was interested, in a sense, I wouldn't have done the investigations quite as well, because I would have always been, maybe there would have been a danger of confirmation bias. Maybe I would have done investigations and have been trying to prove a point, as opposed to the way I actually did it, which was go in really with a completely open mind and say, I will go where the data take me.
When you mentioned that they wanted somebody to go in there who was a skeptic and was willing to tell everybody that all of this was rubbish, of course, the first thing that I think is, well, what was the point? Why did you waste all the money? I don't think that I agree with you. I think that somebody who was a strong believer in UFOs, they're not the right man for the job. You ended up, the way you describe it, you were the right man for the job because you went in there with an open mind, as you noted, and you wanted to look at the data. Shouldn't that have been what they wanted as opposed to somebody who's just going to go in and shoot down all of these ideas? Why did they have this preconceived idea of what they wanted?
Well, I think, first of all, I should say that I made many mistakes in that job. And looking back, and you know, I'm happy to get into this if you like, but looking back, I think I would have done several things different. But to answer your specific question, I think the reason for it is that there were two sides to the job. The internal research and investigation was really at the time I was doing it, before the UK had its Freedom of Information Act. That was really meant for our eyes only. And that was very different from the public side of it. The public side was, as you say, to downplay this whole subject. I mean, we consistently told the media, the public, that this subject was of no defense significance. But behind closed doors, our research and our investigation was suggesting that wasn't necessarily so. And indeed, we were conducting highly classified intelligence studies into all this. And we were far more involved than we let on. So it's not really a case that they wanted someone who thought or said it was rubbish. They wanted someone to toe that line with the public, whatever was going on internally.
So they really wanted to know what's going on.
Oh, yes, it was a genuine research effort. I mean, I've heard some people say, oh, it was just a public relations exercise. Absolutely not. Those of us who...
Well, it was to a degree. Half of it was.
That's fair enough. The public side was the public relations job, but internally, not for public consumption. Absolutely, we wanted to know what this was for several reasons. I mean, firstly, if there is anything flying in British airspace, self-evidently we wanted to know what it was, who's operating it, what are they doing. But if we really were dealing with some exotic phenomenon, whether it was extraterrestrial, whether it was something completely different, we thought that there were things that we could understand from that. I mean, there is a declassified intelligence study, which was codenamed Project Condyne. And this comes out flat and says this: there may be novel military applications that will result from a better understanding of this phenomenon. And it goes on to talk about things like directed energy weapons. So absolutely, we were interested in this.
Now, was there an incident that caused them to gain interest in this subject? Was there something that happened in the early 90s? I mean, we'll talk about Rendlesham, but that was 1980. I mean, was there something immediately preceding this where they thought, okay, this incident happened. We don't know what's going on, but we would like to find out.
Well, I think most of the incidents were like that, and indeed some of the incidents dating back even to the so-called Foo Fighter sightings during the Second World War and the ghost rocket sightings in Scandinavia in the late 40s, those were the sorts of things that caused the Ministry of Defense to get into this subject in the first place in the early 50s. And of course, a whole number of sightings where UFOs were tracked on radar and seen by our own Air Force pilots. Now, when I came to the job in the early 90s, there was no specific incident that triggered that. It was just, as I mentioned earlier, it was just a routine move. Somebody else had done the job before me. I took over and I did it for 3 years. Someone came in afterwards. But I did, as it happens, have quite a big incident that occurred on my watch. And this is something known generally as the Cosford incident from March 1993. And it was a wave of sightings over the entire United Kingdom, dozens of witnesses, many of them military and police, involving a huge triangular-shaped craft that at one point flew directly over two Air Force bases.
So this essentially sounds like the Phoenix Lights.
Very similar. And interestingly, a lot of people always have this idea that UFOs are incredibly quick, and sometimes they are. But with the Cosford incident, what was stunning to me was some of the military witnesses talking about this thing flying over the Air Force bases. And they said this thing was probably going no more than 30 or 40 miles an hour, just really, really low and slow over the base. Now, at one point, one of the witnesses had this thing within sight for some minutes, it then suddenly accelerated away to the horizon at incredible speed. And I asked the witness, who had served 8 years in the Air Force, well, just how quick do you mean? And he said, orders of magnitude faster than a military fast jet.
So this Cosford incident occurs, and it's your job to find out what's going on. And you do all of these investigations, you interview people, you do everything. First off, what is the conclusion that you come to?
Well, the conclusion is that it's unexplained. It's rather like, I characterize the UFO investigations we did as being rather like police investigations into crimes. Just as most, hopefully, crimes will be solved, most UFO sightings are solved, and we're able to close the books on them by saying, yes, this was almost certainly, and whatever it is, aircraft, lights, weather balloons, satellites, meteors, fire lanterns, the list goes on and on. An unsolved UFO case is rather like an unsolved crime with the police. It just sits there on the files until and unless some new witness or some new piece of evidence comes forward. So our conclusion after a week or two looking into this, interviewing people, checking radar tapes, all the usual things, was that there was no conventional explanation that we believed could explain this, and that was it. We didn't know. And that's not a very comfortable position, of course, for government, military, intelligence agencies to be in. No one likes to say, we don't know, when these organizations exist to project power and authority.
Now, as a civilian, it seems to me that if I'm sitting here in my house and I look up and there's a weird triangular object, it flies over my house, I report it to whoever, they can't explain it, everybody moves on with their lives, I'd be like, okay, I wish I knew what it was, but fine. No one can figure it out, we all move on with our lives. However, when an object appears over a military base and it cannot be explained and it behaves in a way that a conventional military aircraft cannot behave, it occurs, nobody can figure out what's going on. To me, it seems that's the kind of thing that you can't just say, well, it's unexplained, now we have to move on. It's disconcerting. This is a military base that an unexplained craft is traveling over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you. But in a sense, even government sometimes runs out of ideas.
I guess what can you do is the best...
Exactly. That's the question that I would throw back at you. And I'm not sure, with the best will in the world, that there is much more that you can do in those circumstances. I mean, you can go back, you can re-interview witnesses, you can recheck radar tapes, but again, eventually you just get into diminishing returns, and events like this are then further and further in the past, and so the question arises, what more can you do? Now, I think there are things, even if it doesn't help you solve the specific incident, but there are things that weren't done that could be done. And I mentioned earlier that I made mistakes during my tour of duty. I think the big one was not doing enough trend analysis. I think all of us were very focused on investigating these cases as they came in, but we were less focused on trying to put the pieces together and say, well, what have we got? What do we think we're dealing with here? And we were also very poor, though there were reasons of classification for this, about reaching out to the civilian scientific community and indeed liaising with other countries and trying to exchange information and data on this.
So what happened to all of this data? You were there for, I don't know, 3-4 years, something like that. And what happened to all of the data that you did amass during that period? Would it be possible to get a hold of it and have somebody today go back and try to search for patterns?
Yes, I think it would. And I mentioned earlier a declassified intelligence study called Project Condyne. One of Project Condyne's aims was to try and do just that, to go back through our own archive and interrogate it. But I think there is some good news here and some bad news. The good news, in response to your question, where are all these files that I worked on, is that most of them have now been declassified and released. And indeed, the Ministry of Defense is nearly at the end of what will be, when it finishes, an 8-year project to declassify and release this material and send it to the UK's National Archives. And I've been involved in that release project, even though I've now left the Ministry of Defense, but I get involved now with my new incarnation, as it were, as somebody who broadcasts and writes about this for the mainstream media. But the bad news is that not a lot of, or not all the material is, although it's been scanned in, it's not really in a format where somebody can interrogate the database that well and pull out these trends in a way that if everything was digitized on the same system, it might be possible to do a bit more. So, as I say, it's mixed news there.
Not to mention it's like 55,000 pages or something like that, right?
That's right. And that's I mentioned earlier this kind of disconnect between the internal side of this and the public side. That is the perfect example. For years, the Ministry of Defense policy was to downplay the true extent of our involvement in this subject. And we told the media and the public, oh, we glance at these reports briefly to see if there's any defense interest in them. But there's nothing particularly significant. And then, of course, comes the disconnect. When we release all this, it's, here it is, oh, 55,000 documents. Well, you don't amass 55,000 documents on a subject that you're not interested in.
Now, you mentioned mistakes that you made, and a couple of them already. Are there other little mistakes, looking back, that you felt, if you could do this again, you would not make this mistake?
I think the first mistake, as I mentioned, was not doing enough trend analysis. The second mistake was not reaching out enough to other countries. Though, in my own defense there, I have to say that obviously with certain countries, we probably wouldn't reach out on anything. And even with allies, there's a limit to what you can do. I think another mistake was not being more proactive on some of the other things that occasionally came up. For example, crop circles is a good example of this. Now, whether you think it's evidence of extraterrestrial visitation or whether you think it's absolute rubbish and it's all made by people. I think that for some months, I just kept an eye on this phenomenon. We kind of looked at the media reports and things. I think we should have just been more proactive, sent out defense scientists into the field, gather the soil, gather the crops, gather the control samples from outside the formation, and just do it. But we were too defensive, and we were victims of our own public relations policy. You know, if we had been caught doing things like that, members of parliament and journalists would have said, well, wait a minute, why are you out in the fields of England looking at this if you're telling us all the time you're not really interested? So we should have just bitten the bullet and said, look, okay, we are interested. Of course we are. And we should have been more bullish about doing things like going out into the fields.
What is your conclusion about crop circles? Because you mentioned that you can believe that they're of extraterrestrial origin or they're complete rubbish. And I don't necessarily believe they're of extraterrestrial origin. I don't know of what origin they are, but if it is an unnatural phenomenon of some sort, it could be both in the sense that some of these crop circles are real, whatever the source of them is, and others are just made by people, probably a lot of them. But one does not necessarily exclude the other.
That's true. I mean, I have to say that having looked at this, I am pretty much a crop circle skeptic. But that doesn't mean that I stick to my point that we should have been more assertive. I mean, after all, we were the government. We should have been a little bit gung-ho if necessary. We shouldn't have been so on the back foot with this and worried that the media would have said, oh, but, why are you doing this? We should have said, because we're the government and we can. And if that sounds a bit flip, and I apologize. I mean, that's not my intention, but it was very, very frustrating. But to answer your question, I am a crop circle skeptic.
I'm a skeptic about a lot of things, but I guess the parallel that I would make is when you read a newspaper article and it says, for example, everybody knows all of these crop circles were made by two guys. Or the other one in America here. Well, everybody knows there was one guy with a carved foot that was responsible for all of the Bigfoot prints in the 60s, 70s, and who knows, maybe even today. It's sort of like, sure, I'm sure there were two guys that made a lot of crop circles, and I'm sure there was a guy with a wooden foot that made a lot of fake footprints, but to claim that that guy and those guys are responsible for everything is, I think, more ridiculous than the idea that there is a Bigfoot or an alien making crop circles.
It is. I totally agree. And I think that sort of thing is just sloppy journalism. I mean, it's absurd to suggest that. I mean, it would be far better an analysis if people writing that sort of piece had said, yes, there were two guys in the UK who first conceived of this, and then they had a number of imitators, and groups of these people became more and more sophisticated, and between them all, we think that everything can be explained. But yes, as you say, to suggest, as some still do, that it was just two guys with planks and ropes doing every crop circle, or one guy with a wooden foot doing all the Bigfoot stuff is ridiculous. I mean, and then you get the danger, of course, that you throw out the baby with the bathwater. And I think that would be unfortunate.
We're going to go to Rendlesham here in a minute, but since we were talking about restricted airspace, I've got to ask you about this. There was a UFO sighting, I believe it was 2008. It was over the Chicago O'Hare Airport, a very, very famous sighting. And I guess it's one of the best, I mean, the tons of witnesses, but no photographs. And I think about if this would have happened today and everybody has their iPhone and everything like that. I mean, we would have surely, you would think, have had something in the way of photographs. What do you know of that case?
I think it was Now you got me confused on the date. I thought it was 2006-07, but yeah.
It may have been, yeah.
Yeah, whatever it was. I mean, it was around about that period of time. And you're right. The reason I say that is I'm trying to think of how prevalent everyone's cell phones with the cameras were. But I guess it was right over the thing is, it was right over the C-17 gate, as I recall. And, of course, as such, although an airport is a really crowded place, it probably wasn't visible from inside the terminal. Not that people pay much attention to things in the terminal anyway, except is my flight on time. I think what happened, I mean, I do know this case quite well, and what happened is that a number of the gate ramp personnel and indeed some of the flight crew, including pilots, did see this. But basically, they were then shut down by the airline and told, you know, you will not discuss this in public because we, the airline, are concerned about the reputational damage that might ensue from people associating our personnel with UFO sightings. And this is something I've come across many, many times with most of the major airlines and indeed with the Air Force itself, that pilots are reluctant to report UFO sightings because of the fear of disbelief and ridicule and the fear, sometimes real, sometimes not, that there would be potentially adverse career consequences. But to me, this is a nonsense. Self-evidently, a UFO, whatever it might turn out to be, in such crowded airspace, is an air safety issue. Whether you're a believer or a skeptic about UFOs doesn't matter. That's a reason to take this seriously, and I think the Chicago O'Hare sighting is a tragedy of kind of corporate cover-up, so to speak.
It wasn't a story that everybody saw it, and then apparently like shot straight up through a cloud and punched a hole in the cloud or something of this nature. It was a very, very visual, I mean, you can imagine it in your head, and it's just amazing nobody got a shot of this.
Or nobody that we know. Maybe somebody did and has kept quiet.
That's true.
You know, fingers crossed on that. And of course, the FAA, then, when they got to hear about this, they said, well, there is this phenomenon called a hole punch cloud. So it was very convenient for the FAA then to say, well, we're aware of this. It's a weather phenomenon. That's what it was.
Let's cut to the chase here very quickly. Your thoughts on all of these phenomenon in the sense that I think it's very clear if you look at all of the evidence from all over the world that there's something going on with anomalous craft. Now, I don't know what they are. I don't know if they're alien craft. I don't know if they're craft from another dimension. I don't know if they're all built here on Earth and it's just technology that we know nothing about. I think it would be foolish to say that there's nothing going on. What would you say?
I think you've just pretty much hit the nail on the head. I don't see reason to disagree with anything you've said there. I mean, we know for a fact, of course, that there are various secret prototype aircraft and drones, some our own, others belonging to other nations, some friendly, some not, things that are flying in our airspace that we won't hear about, that won't be publicly declared for 10, 15 years. We know that. And the possibility that some of these things, for example, might be Russian, Chinese, some other nation, again, illustrates why we should be concerned about this. Yeah, we can't rule out, of course, some of the more exotic possibilities, extraterrestrial visitation, interdimensional intrusion, intertemporal intrusion of some sort. You know, a few years ago, of course, much of this would have been dismissed as sci-fi, but now the sorts of research being done at the Large Hadron Collider, the CERN facility, talks quite openly about one of the aims being an attempt to locate previously so-called hidden dimensions, some of the dimensions that indeed are necessary if things like string theory are to be correct. So kind of, you know, theoretical physics says that those hidden dimensions should be there. So who knows? And I'm not saying to you, oh yeah, I came across while I was working for the government proof that this was aliens or anything. I genuinely don't know, but I think it's an important mystery, and I certainly can't rule out these exotic possibilities. And you know, I know it's a bit of a soundbite, but something that we often used to say at the Ministry of Defense on this was that the skeptics had to be right every day. The believers only have to be right once.
1994, your job came to an end in terms of investigating this for the Ministry of Defense. Why did it come to such a quick ending, in the sense that I would think that if you're really going to do an investigation, you need more than 3 years. But apparently not. What happened?
Well, I was promoted, so good news for me. But in fact, at the time, tour lengths of 3 to 4 years were normal, certainly among civilian employees in the Ministry of Defense, but also in the military. That kind of tour length is not unusual. And yeah, you're quite right. You could say, well, maybe it's not long enough. But, you know, that same problem exists right across government. And you can have a debate about, you know, maybe you should stick someone there for 10 years. But then,
that actually would be the first thing that I would say. You were there for 3 years engulfed in all of this, and they promoted you out of it?
Yes. So, but, you know, you see the point. I mean, all these posts exist at a certain grade, at a certain rank. Are you then, if you say to someone, you know, this is a 10-year posting, what you're really saying is that you can't develop your career by getting experience of other areas for 10 years. You can't get promoted. So that really doesn't work in terms of the way that the Ministry of Defense career paths are mapped out. But yeah, I acknowledge that it does lead to a lack of deep specialists. But generally speaking, if you see someone who's been in the same job for 10 years in government, certainly when I was there, the feeling was, well, that person's probably getting a little stale. Sometimes there are advantages in posting someone out, bringing someone in who's new and can look at it with a fresh perspective, particularly if you haven't solved the mystery. It's kind of like police. You know, you bring in a new team, do a cold case review even.
So you get promoted out, and what became of the program?
Oh, it continued. I mean, just as many people had done that job before me, many did it afterwards. So I handed over to somebody else, and they did the job for, I think, 3 or 4 years. Someone did it after that, and all this went on all the way till 2009, right up until December 2009, when the whole program was terminated as part of a wider round of defense cuts. But essentially, the thing had run from 1953 through to 2009, so much longer than Project Blue Book in the States.
Let's talk about Rendlesham here. You wrote the book on the subject, and you have stated that the Rendlesham Forest incident, I believe you've stated, to you is more important than Roswell. And for a lot of listeners here in the United States, they have probably heard of Rendlesham, but certainly not to the degree that they've heard of Roswell. Take everybody through what happened, the incident at Rendlesham Forest.
Okay, well, the Rendlesham Forest incident took place over a series of 3 nights in December 1980 and involved 2 United States Air Force bases in the United Kingdom. It's part of the wider U.S. military presence in Europe. On the first night, strange lights were seen in Rendlesham Forest, which is between the twin bases of Bentwaters and Woodbridge, and a patrol went out to investigate, thinking that perhaps an aircraft had crashed and started a fire. They actually then encountered a UFO, not lights in the sky, but actually landed on the ground. The 2 witnesses who got closest to this were John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, And it's John and Jim who I teamed up with to write the book Encounter in Rendlesham Forest. And they saw this thing up close and personal. Jim sketched the craft in his USAF police notebook. He sketched strange symbols that were seen on the side of this. And after a while, the UFO rose slowly up, cleared the tops of the trees, and shot away at high speed. Now, subsequently, that landing site was investigated, examined forensically. They found indentations in the ground, and critically, they found scorch marks on the trees and radioactivity levels, which the MOD's defense intelligence staff assessed as being significantly higher than background. The UFO then returned on two subsequent nights, and on the third and final night, witnesses included the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt. And he and a team of men were out in the forest when they saw the UFO themselves, and at one point it fired light beams down just in front of them. And Colonel Holt, years later, when he talked to me about this, he said, well, you know, I didn't know what this was, these light beams firing down at our feet. He said, was it a weapon? Was it communication? Was it a warning? What was it? He didn't know. And this is, I think, almost the perfect storm of a UFO case. And this is, in fact, why I say that in many ways this is more significant than Roswell, because I think not only is it more recent, but it has almost everything you could want in a UFO case. It was briefly tracked on radar. We have, as I mentioned, the radioactivity levels. And all of this is set down in the Ministry of Defense's own file on this, now declassified and released. So unlike some of these other UFO cases where there are no documents or documents that people say might be fakes, you can read about this in the government's own archives. And that and the fact that, unlike Roswell, all these people are still very much with us and many of them are talking about it. Whereas Roswell, of course, really the last of the witnesses with any direct connection have passed now, certainly the main witnesses. But with Rendlesham, they are talking. They are talking not only to the media, but they're talking to each other. And this is creating a sort of network, really.
So realistically, if we had proof that an alien craft crashed at Roswell, there were bodies, the bodies were taken away, this would be more significant just because of all of the... you'd pretty much have proof if you had alien bodies. We don't have any of that with Roswell, is what you're saying. We have some very questionable documents, the MJ-12 documents, which I would say... Would you say that most people at this point believe those are hoaxed?
I think a significant proportion of people believe they're hoaxed. And certainly, I mean, in a sense, even if sizable numbers of people in the UFO community think they're real, the point is, how many mainstream journalists think, oh, that's interesting, those things are probably real? I would say just about, you know, zero. Whereas, when you point to Rendlesham Forest, there is no dispute about this. And indeed, journalists for most of the major newspapers and TV networks all around the world have covered this subject. And the files are there for all to read in the National Archives, including, for example, that Defense Intelligence Staff assessment that talks about the radiation levels.
When did these documents on Rendlesham get released?
Some of them were released back in 2001. There was a crusading investigative journalist called Georgina Bruni who applied to have them released under the Code of Practice on Access to Government Information, which was a forerunner of the UK's Freedom of Information Act. But most of them were released only years later, and indeed it was 2008 that the Ministry of Defense started this ongoing program to release all these UFO files. And that's still going on. And indeed, the final files are likely to be released either very late this year or next year, 2016. And it is expected that there will be some more Rendlesham Forest documents in that final release of Ministry of Defence UFO files. So there is more to come.
What was the path to writing this book? Was it the fact that a lot of documents were getting released, you had more information, you had official documentation of this, or what was the, I guess, how did it all come about?
It was two things. Firstly, as you say, it was the fact that the Ministry of Defence was releasing all this material. So for the first time, we had an audit trail of the government's own documents to tell this story. And but the second point, I guess the more fundamental one, was that a few years ago, I was fortunate enough to meet on several occasions both John Burroughs and Jim Penniston, really the two witnesses at the heart of this whole incident, though arguably Colonel Holt is the third party in all this, who is also the key witness. But I had met up with John Burroughs and Jim Penniston, and you know, one day we were kind of just bouncing this around, and they said, well, you know, there are so many misleading TV treatments of this, and there's so much nonsense on the internet. You know, maybe we should write something. And I said to them, well, you know, let me know if I can help. I have written a number of books with major publishing houses, as opposed to some of these self-published and small New Age press kind of books that you see. And I said, and I've got a literary agent, and he's well connected with all of the so-called big six, for example, in the publishing industry. And so we did decide to collaborate, and we soon signed a deal with one of the big six, Macmillan Publishers. And we wrote this book, Encounter in Rendlesham Forest. And really, the three of us wrote it together and put it out there. And of course, because of their background as United States Air Force personnel and my background as Ministry of Defense, this book was the only book on UFOs, is the only book on UFOs, ever to have needed security clearance from both the British and the American government. So that's a sort of fun fact for this interview. But it was quite a struggle to put everything together. We have interviews with witnesses, we have documents, we have transcripts, and you know, we've attempted to just put it all together and tell the story, and we have not tried to tell readers what to think. We've just really placed all the information for the first time in the public domain and said, well, this is it. This is what's in the files of the United States Air Force, the DOD, the British Ministry of Defense. We don't necessarily know what all this is at the end of the day, but here's the data.
Do you have your own personal theory at the end of the day about what all of this is? It's very clear. I mean, there's actually, if you go to your website, as you look at the book here, Lord Hill Norton says, my position, both privately and publicly expressed over the last dozen of years or more, is that there are only two possibilities, either A, an intrusion into our airspace and a landing by unidentified craft took place at Rendlesham as described, or B, the deputy commander of an operational nuclear-armed U.S. Air Force base in England and a large number of his enlisted men are either hallucinating or lying. I think it's very clear it's A. Now, that doesn't mean that we know what A is. We only know it's an unidentified object. Do you have a theory about what A might be?
I honestly don't. I can tell you what it wasn't, but I can't tell you what it was. And I mean, with all of these things, yes, it's almost impossible, I think, to refute Lord Hill Norton's quote, which you just read there. But in all of this, we at the Ministry of Defense were saying there is sometime with some of this, I suppose, you know, a thin line between, well, are we talking Russian or Martian? I mean, it seemed to us that some of these sightings involved technology ahead of what we'd got. But was it some deep black project, maybe American, maybe Russian, maybe somebody else, or was it? Was it indeed from somewhere else? And we didn't know. We, hand on heart, we didn't know. I know a lot of people have accused me of being part of the cover-up, part of the conspiracy, guardian of the secret, whatever. Honestly, I'm not. The real, I suppose, scandal, in a sense, is that government actually, so far as I'm aware, doesn't know what these things are. And I think, on a level, that is scandalous, because we should. But there were not a whole bunch of us sitting around plotting how we were going to keep some great truth from the public. That's not what the job was about.
This was 35 years ago that this happened. And when you look at the documents and what the craft looked like, the sketches, the descriptions of its behavior, is there anything in 2015 that reminds you of this in the sense that could it have been an early prototype of something that we saw later, or is the way that everything was described still far beyond anything that you would see today in the military?
I think it's far beyond. In terms of the shape, the only thing that comes remotely close is a British unmanned aerial vehicle codenamed Taranis, named for the Celtic god of thunder, I believe. But that takes off and lands pretty much like a conventional aircraft, and it doesn't do the sort of vertical takeoff that was seen in Rendlesham. Neither does it do this incredible transition from a virtual hover to high Mach speeds in an instant. And in any case, Taranis wasn't even on the drawing board back in 1980. So it is exceptionally difficult to reconcile what was seen at Rendlesham with anything that's out now. I guess the only point is that we can never say never with this, because in the deep black world, there's always a chance that even for those of us in government, there was something at a deeper level.
The reason I bring it up is because I've always kind of been fascinated by the airship flap here in this country in the late 1800s. It was, in some ways, a device. I guess really when you read witness reports and they talk about the way that it operated, it really didn't make a lot of sense. But when you just read the overall descriptions, it sounds like a blimp, a dirigible, something of that nature.
Yeah.
It seemed like something that later we would have these sorts of things. And
that's it. You can look at something like that and say, you know what, that's probably what it was. But you can't do that with Rendlesham.
Sure. Have you followed the, I mean, what can you tell us about the airship flap?
Not much. I mean, I know about it from my review of the UFO literature, but I don't have any great insight into it. I mean, I can say that there were some similar sightings in the UK, albeit a little later, but I have no inside information on that, I'm afraid.
As far as Roswell goes, we had the whole Roswell slides debacle, and it's still something that people talk about to this day. We've briefly mentioned it. There's no real good documentation whatsoever. I mean, on the cover of your Rendlesham book, I mean, it flat out says, the inside story of the world's best documented UFO incident. We have very, very little documentation of Roswell. We have a lot of witness statements, but as far as actual physical evidence documentation, we have virtually nothing. A lot of people believe that whether it was an alien craft or not, something weird happened there. I think that's pretty much a given. What are your thoughts on Roswell?
Yeah, I agree. I think something weird happened, and I don't think it's something quite as straightforward as a weather balloon. I mean, this was, after all, the 509th Bomb Group, probably the most elite squadron anywhere in the United States, arguably anywhere in the world at the time, the only atomic bomb-capable squadron. And to, you know, these were the best of the best. So all the characters that were posted in, whether it's as pilots or as intelligence officers, were the brightest of the bright. And they were not ones to stumble across weather balloons, which, of course, were hardly uncommon in the area, and say, oh, look, you know, here's one of these flying discs. The GAO, of course, when they looked into Roswell years later, did find that some of the signal traffic and other communications between Roswell, Army Airfield as it was at the time, and higher authority had been destroyed without proper authorization. So, of course, there probably were documents at one time. It's just that we don't have them anymore. As to what Roswell was, I don't know. I mean, I think the problem with Roswell is that now it's kind of when, what is the saying, that when the last soldier from a particular war passes, you know, the whole thing goes from living memory into history. And now Roswell is firmly history. And I don't have any insights into it, I'm afraid.
We could talk about UFOs forever, but before we run out of time, I wanted to talk to you about conspiracy theories. I know that some people are going to be very upset to hear this, but I often have people request that I bring on guests to talk about big-time conspiracies. And a lot of times, I avoid it, because when it comes to conspiracies, I don't buy a lot of the very famous conspiracies that you'll read about nowadays. Obviously, there have been conspiracies throughout history. Maybe even JFK. I'm not even sold on that one. But a lot of times when I hear conspiracy theories, to me, they just don't make sense to me. You have to really, really stretch to make the conspiracy. There seems to be this need for, I'm just going to babble here. So I'm going to let you, because I know you kind of have sort of the same mindset when it comes to conspiracies. What are your thoughts on the conspiracy theorists as a whole?
Well, I've written a very detailed critique of this, which is on my website, and I go into a lot of detail, not really on individual conspiracy theories, moon landings, JFK, 9/11, etc., but about the principles more generally, the principles that underlie conspiracy theories.
Why people believe.
Why, exactly, why people believe. And I think it's a number of different things. I think part of it is a feeling of disempowerment, a feeling that you know, you are an individual and that the whole might of the state is weighed up against you. And I think recent media stories, you know, a lot of them true, about secrecy and the surveillance society have played into this belief and played into this feeling of disempowerment and anger. And I think that is a very real part. The internet, of course, has played a huge part in conspiracy theories, which sometimes I think you can view almost as memes, the way that they spread throughout society. But I think that, you know, some, as you said at the outset, some conspiracy theories turn out to be true. There are, of course, real conspiracies all the time. I have a very good example of a proven conspiracy theory, which a lot of people haven't heard of. To many Americans, it might be quite obscure, but from the troubles in Northern Ireland, there was a bomb attack in Cloudy, and there is good evidence to show, and this was the result of a police inquiry years later, so this is the police saying this, that the state and the Catholic Church and the police at the time conspired to suppress the fact that they knew who had planted this bomb that killed a number of people, including a child. And it was actually a Catholic priest. But at the time, though they had very good evidence, the Northern Ireland office, the Catholic Church, and the Royal Ulster Constabulary said the whole province will go up in flames if we arrest a Catholic priest for this bombing. So they just agreed to move him. So that's an example of a really well-documented conspiracy theory. But some of the other more famous ones, less so. But I think they tell us something interesting about ourselves, and I think they tell us something interesting about society in the 20th and the 21st century. So conspiracy theories are interesting, but they're not necessarily true.
I think what it is to me is, I don't know if Bigfoot exists. I don't know what unidentified flying objects are. I don't know if they're ghosts. I don't know if there's ESP. But a lot of this stuff, if you want to do a show and you want to talk about it and you want to come up with theories, to me, a lot of it is largely harmless. Okay, I interviewed a guy who thought that he saw Bigfoot. I mean, it doesn't change the world in any way whether he's telling the truth or lying. But with conspiracy theories, it feels to me like if you buy into some of these conspiracy theories, it's not harmless. And in fact, sometimes buying into some of these conspiracy theories can actually do far more harm than good.
I totally agree. I think there's a couple of angles on that. There's certainly some evidence to suggest that some mass shooters, and I'm talking particularly about, I think, Loughner in Tucson, had been influenced by conspiracy theories, and that fueled a sense of anger against society as a whole that maybe tripped him over the edge. And I know that does crop up in a number of these other mass shooting cases. So I think there is a big danger there that if we are uncritical about conspiracy theories and we don't pick people up on this sort of thing, that you fuel that kind of anger against not just the authorities, but against society as a whole that can have disastrous and fatal consequences. The other thing is there's no getting away from the fact that there's an unhealthy streak of anti-Semitism in some of these conspiracy theories.
A lot of them.
You know, where people start talking about small groups of families secretly running the world. You know, a lot of this is just code for anti-Jewish sentiment. And, you know, that's not to say that you can't be, as some people are, legitimate critics of, say, the state of Israel, which is a completely different thing. But you've only got to look at some of this conspiracy stuff about bankers and crooks and things, and you know, you can see there's a darker side to that.
NickPope.net is the website, and if you just Google Nick Pope, you'll find everything you need to know. And I want to give you an opportunity to get some plugs in here, and also, what kind of projects are you working on these days?
Well, I'm doing a wide range of TV shows, you know, and continuing to appear on shows like Ancient Aliens and NASA's Unexplained Files. I have a number of conferences coming up. I try to update them on my website, which, as you say, is nickpope.net. So if you go to the latest news section there, I've got conference coming up in Philadelphia, conference in Rio Rancho. I think I've got Laughlin coming up, Los Angeles.
You're Orange out County. Almost every single weekend.
Yeah, it's busy at the moment.
Yeah, you got September, actually September 26th is over, but October 9th and 10th, MUFON, Pennsylvania. You've got the 2015 New Mexico UFO Conference, October 17th, November 13th, 14th, and 15th. StarWorks USA Annual UFO Symposium. You've got stuff on November 17th, November 18th. All of this up at nickpope.net. And let's talk about the book as well, the Rendlesham Forest book, and all of your other books.
Yeah, Encounter in Rendlesham Forest is the latest one. Again, probably the quickest way to order it is just through nickpope.net under the book section. Links to Amazon, wherever you may be, US or UK. And my other books, too, Open Skies, Closed Minds, An Overview of the UFO Mystery, The Uninvited, An Overview of the Alien Abduction Mystery, and my two sci-fi novels, which blended what I know about UFOs with what I know about war fighting and crisis management in government. And those two sci-fi novels are Operation Thunderchild and Operation Lightning Strike.
And a couple of these, actually, the Operation Lightning Strike, Operation Thunderchild, and The Uninvited, you can all grab for $5.99 on Kindle. And there's a ton of different options for Encounter at Rendlesham Forest, hardcover, paperback, although if you want the paperback, you better get it quick. Kindle version as well, and is noted all of that up at nickpope.net. And Nick, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. I had a great time, and obviously we barely scratched the surface. Hopefully someday we can do this again.
Absolutely. I've enjoyed it and look forward to coming on again at a future date. Thank you.
And of course, we'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio, Dark Matter, Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio and the Dark Matter Digital Network. Want to thank Nick Pope for coming on the show here today. A great interview. And we've got an email here from Tom, which kind of plays into what I wanted to say about Nick Pope. He says, Brian, you had a caller just before Nick Pope came on your Sunday, October 4th show. He described an oval UFO that had rectangular underside panels with insets of a pyramidal texture, glowing balls on some of the texture. The description bears a striking resemblance to my sighting. Is there any way I can listen to the October 4th show again through your site? And is there a way for me to connect with the caller? I actually don't have any of the caller's information, but if you missed any portion of this show, whether it be that call from earlier, or if you missed any portion of the Nick Pope interview, it is going to be up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. About a half hour before the live show goes off the air, it will remain up there for an entire week. So yes, if you're listening for the first time, if you just tuned in, if you missed any portion of the show, AfterDarkRadioShow.com is the place to go for the replay. It will be up there for one full week. And that means if you are listening live on October 4th right now, if you head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, you can check out last week's show. Head up there and grab that while you can, because in about 45 minutes, it is going to be gone. Big thanks to Nick Pope. We'll get him back on the show at some point. And I got an email here as well from Tina, and not really a UFO story, but it's very interesting. Says, a friend of mine brought up an interesting story at a barbecue this evening and recently read an article about a new technology that can transform carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into carbon nanofibers for use in making nanotubes for electronics, aerospace, construction, and other industries, and be a potential solution for climate change. The scientist working on it says that using this technology, quote, in an area less than 10% the size of the Sahara, could bring CO2 in the atmosphere down to pre-industrial levels in just 10 years. And there's a whole bunch of articles about it. One of them here is in the MIT Technology Review, technologyreview.com. It says here, a new method for taking carbon dioxide directly from the air and converting it to oxygen and nanoscale fibers made of carbon could lead to an inexpensive way to make a valuable building material and may even serve as a weapon against climate change. Carbon fibers are increasingly being used as a structural material on the aerospace, automotive, and other industries, which value its strength and lightweight. The usual attributes of carbon fibers, which also include electrical conductivity, are enhanced at the nanoscale. The problem is that it's very expensive to make carbon fibers, much less nanofibers. This professor here, Stuart Licht, says his group's newly demonstrated technology, which both captures the carbon dioxide from the air and employs an electrochemical process to convert it to carbon, nanofibers, and oxygen, is more efficient and potentially a lot cheaper than existing methods. But it's more than just a simpler, less expensive way. It is also a means of storing and sequestering carbon dioxide in a useful manner. And as noted, they are hoping that there is a possibility that perhaps this could help slow down climate change. As for the technology's emission-cutting potential, researchers are optimistic. They calculate that given an area less than 10% the size of the Sahara, the method could remove enough carbon dioxide to make global atmospheric levels return to pre-industrial levels within 10 years, even if we keep emitting the greenhouse gas at a high rate during that period. TechnologyReview.com is the place you want to go if you want to read more about this. Let's go to the Skype line. You're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian. It's Omar from Calgary.
Omar, what's going on?
Doing all right. Just finished listening to some of that interviews. It's pretty good. I just wanted to get your take on, I've been hearing a lot about deathbed confessions that some people make. For example, lately, I think it was like last week, I saw the one where a police officer made a confession. He's dying, and that he helped Tupac fake his own death. And not only just that, but there's always been confessions about other things, like talking about today's subject.
Roswell.
Some people, yeah, like Roswell and other people who are like 4 or 5-star generals, whatever. They get on there and they're saying that, yeah, we've been visited by, you know, aliens, and that there are the bodies and they were there. And, you know, there's the government keeping all this information from the people. What would you say? Would that be credible? Like, for example, in a court of law, I think there's a lot of credibility to a deathbed confession.
Yeah, I think they are admissible in court. And in fact, there's a very good book. It's called Witness to Roswell. And as I noted when I did the show with Nick, or the interview here earlier tonight, I don't know what happened at Roswell. I don't know if I believe it's aliens. I don't know. But I do believe that something happened there. And if you read Witness to Roswell, it's essentially a collection of witness reports of what they saw at Roswell. And there are deathbed confessions in there. And this sounds flippant, but I've never died. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. Maybe there are some people who on their deathbed want to leave one last practical joke on the world. I don't know. I have no idea. But for a lot of people, deathbed confessions are taken very, very seriously. And if you have a link to the Tupac deal, can you send that to me?
I'll send it. I'm not near a computer right now, but yeah, it was.
Anytime.
I saw it on Facebook last week, and you've had the same thing with, there was, I think a couple of years ago, a CIA agent that was dying said that he was directly involved with Marilyn Monroe's murder and all that stuff. And I just find it kind of fascinating how someone, and I guess if you commit, killed a bunch of people, you can just say you've killed a bunch of people and not say where the bodies are and kind of bring all that up for the families as in a sick, kind of twisted way to torture them after you're dead, you know, kind of thing. Just name names and not give whereabouts of remains and details and that kind of stuff. So like, it could go both ways. It could be bad or it could be good, I guess.
Yeah, I want to thank you very much for the call. Send me that stuff if you get a chance. And the thing with deathbed confessions, it's interesting because you got to think about lifetime confessions as well. I mean, some people have stories that maybe, how can I say this? Not so much that they're not true, because I don't want to make it sound like they're necessarily lying. But sometimes people have memories of things that happened that really aren't the way that things really went down. Or maybe they've been led to believe something in their life and they tell the story over and over, and the next thing you know, they believe it. And as many, many years and decades go by, I mean, maybe as they're doing their deathbed confession, they honestly believe that their deathbed confession is 100% true, and in fact, it's not. And they weren't meaning to mislead. They firmly believe that all of this was true, but memories and things that you remember from decades and decades ago. I mean, I'm sure there are many stories that I remember from my childhood that really aren't the way that it really happened. It's just, that's what I've remembered. That's what I've told myself. I've repeated the story. Next thing you know, I believe it. And if I left a deathbed confession about it, I'm sure that I believe I was 100% telling the truth, and maybe I wasn't. Now, obviously, if your memory is handling alien bodies or helping Tupac fake his death or whatever the story is, I mean, maybe you got to really think about that in the sense that it's a pretty vivid, it's a pretty interesting story. It's not something that you can easily mistake. I mean, you either feel like you really helped him or you didn't. You either believe the story is true or not. Sometimes stories are specific enough and serious enough that it's either a true story on a deathbed confession, or it's somebody doing one last great practical joke, and who will ever know, because it is, in fact, a deathbed confession. I did look up the Servant Girl Annihilator, which somebody had called or emailed about earlier. A serial killer popularly known as the Servant Girl Annihilator preyed upon the city of Austin, Texas, during the years 1884 and 1885. The Servant Girl murders talked about in the New York Times. And in fact, this was shortly The serial murders represent an early example of a serial killer operating in the United States 3 years before the Jack the Ripper murders in Whitechapel. In her book, Jack the Ripper, The American Connection, Shirley Harrison asserted that the Texas killer and Jack the Ripper were one and the same, namely, a man named James Maybrick. According to author Philip Sugden, in The Complete History of Jack the Ripper, the conjecture that the murders were committed by the same hand originated in October 1888, when an editor with the Atlanta Constitution proposed the conjecture following the murders of Stride and Edowes by Jack the Ripper. London authorities questioned several American cowboys, one of whom, according to the authors of Jack the Ripper A to Z, was possibly Buck Taylor, a performer in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, who was born in Fredericksburg, Texas, about 70 miles west of Austin. Also does, in fact, talk about the Malay Cook suspect, an individual who had been employed in a small hotel in Austin in 1885, who some people believe ended up going and becoming Jack the Ripper. So that might be interesting for a future show. I believe we've done some shows on Jack the Ripper in the past, but I don't recall talking about the Servant Girl Annihilator, so maybe that's something for the future. We're running low on time, everybody, so once again, I'd like to point out AfterDarkRadioShow.com. If you missed any portion of this show, it is going to replay up there at AfterDarkRadioshow.com. It is a free MP3 download. You can grab it for the next week. If you are a first-time listener, every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, we are here live on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Same time slot as Art Bell has Monday through Friday, also 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. So if you're in the habit of listening to Art and you stumbled upon this show, we're here live every Sunday night, so check us out. Spread the word to your friends. Of course, the shows can be listened to free live on the TuneIn Radio app by searching the Dark Matter Digital Network. If you're listening to this show on iTunes or elsewhere and you want to hear the Dark Matter Digital Network, it is free. TuneIn Radio is the best place to go. You can also find links at artbell.com, afterdarkradioshow.com, and many other places as well. But grab the TuneIn Radio app for your smartphone and search Dark Matter Digital, and you will find the network. You can hear Art Bell Monday through Friday. You can hear this show on Sunday nights. And that is it from here. I want to thank everybody for listening. Of course, Keith Rowland, as always, the great Art Bell, all of the callers and listeners, my email address and everything. You can always contact me at any point during the week, and I will talk about the most interesting news on the show next week as well. So thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you again next time, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.